You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Good morning, my fellow shelterers. It's an absolute pleasure to welcome you to what I think is an amazing venue here at Greenbelt. And it is my absolute pleasure to welcome back to the stage Miranda, who did... Was anybody here yesterday? Yeah, it was fantastic. So thank you ever so much, Miranda. And over to you. Thank you.
Thanks. Hi, everyone. Right, most of you have been given a blank piece of paper. Don't worry if you haven't, because you can get it. You need that for the second half. We're not doing haikus today. If you were here yesterday, we're doing something else. Thank you. So don't make notes on your blank piece of paper. Keep it for the second half. And if you have arrived late or haven't got one yet, we can get you them at the second half. So I'm Miranda Threlfall-Holmes. I'm based in Liverpool. I've written a book on reading the Bible, which is available in the bookshop, should you happen to want to buy it. Someone's cheering for the book. Excellent. Feel free to get that if you don't understand what I'm saying today, read the book. We're going to focus today on the story of making bricks without straw. There are a few handouts of it floating around because some people like to have text in front of them, but you don't need the text in front of you. We're not going to be using it in the same way as we were yesterday. And if you want to get it on your phone, it's Exodus chapter 5, not Exodus chapter 4, as I said in our church the other week when we were practicing this. And we got halfway through the Exodus 4 reading before I went, oh, actually, no, can you skip on a chapter? So the reading took ages. And if you were here yesterday, you'll be familiar with the format. If you weren't, I'm basically going to talk about the reading for about half an hour. And then we're going to do some kind of collaborative writing, which is not about you being able to write well. It's a different exercise from the one yesterday. I'm hoping that these exercises, if you're the kind of person who sometimes needs things to do in a church, are also a helpful kind of idea for you to take away. But it's not about being able to write well. It's purely a collaborative way of engaging together and then each receiving a gift from the group. So we'll be doing a different one of those, and that's what your bit of paper is for. I'm going to take my top off because I'm hot. So we were talking yesterday about how the Bible tells us quite a lot about how to have hope, but surprisingly little about how to go about making hope. And I just ended yesterday with a hint of what I was going to focus on a bit more today, which is that what the Bible does give us is a lot of stories. The Bible is basically full of stories, and particularly the first five books of the Old Testament are full of stories. There's folk tales. There are myths, there are campfire stories, there are tellings of history, kind of bardic retellings. Some of them seem to be original, they're not known anywhere else. They seem to have been written by the people who were telling them, by the people of Israel. Some are loosely based on history, some of them are reworkings of even more ancient tales. It's quite well known now that things like stories of the flood have echoes in Gilgamesh epics and so on. There's a lot of study happened in the last couple of hundred years around ancient Near East stories. And I'm fairly sure that these weren't the only stories that were told and retold around campfires and in story time to children and by bards at festivals and celebrations and gatherings. But one of the ways that I like to think about what we've got in the Bible, and particularly in the Old Testament, is that this is like the collection, the kind of curated collection of the stories that people over generations and generations and generations found most helpful. So, you know, if you read Grimm's fairy tales, a lot of them we don't tell now, but we still go to pantomimes every year of some of the best ones. And I suspect it was like that. There were lots and lots of stories, and these are the ones that people found helpful in some way. And it's one of the things that I think really helps with understanding the Old Testament, because a lot of the time when people read the Bible, if you make the mistake like I did when I was 12 of going, I'm going to read the Bible and starting on page one, it's kind of fine through Genesis and Exodus. And then you get into Numbers and you start going, what on earth is this book? But I think one of the ways that's best to understand it is to think some of the really weird stories, some of the really horrible stories, and there is a lot in there that's horrible, and that really freaks people out when they come to it for the first time. But one of the things that is to think that these are stories that are told for a reason. They're told because people have told them, and we do tell horror stories around campfires. We tell ghost stories and horror stories. because they've made people think, they have somehow sparked thought. And often what those thoughts spark in us, which are, oh my goodness, that's horrendous, I don't want to worship a god like that, for example, I think are exactly what the stories are meant to spark in us. They're meant to make us think and discuss. And that was the way that the Jewish tradition was, that you told a story and then people discussed it and thought about it. The church that I'm camping with here, St. Bride's, generally doesn't have a sermon on a Sunday morning. We read a story and then we discuss it as if we were around a campfire, as if we were saying, well, what's going on here? How does this make us feel? Does that really, really piss us off? You know, what do we want to say about this story? And it's particularly true. I've gone off script now. I'm going to go on too long if I don't stick to my script. It's particularly true of those first five books of the Bible. There's always such a huge range of people at Greenbelt. So you probably all know that the first five books of the Bible are known as the Pentateuch, Pent, five. They've been described as the Old Testament of the Old Testament. So when most of the rest of the Old Testament was being written, the prophets that we were looking at yesterday and so on, the first five books were already old. It's a bit like it blew my mind to discover that the ancient Egyptians were doing archaeology on the pyramids. because you know, these things were already old later. So Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, they were already ancient scripture. And they're sometimes known as the books of the book of Moses. So when we hear about Moses in the New Testament, when, for example, the risen Jesus meets the disciples on the road to Emmaus and says, you know, starting with Moses and the prophets, when they say Moses, they don't mean Moses the person. They mean these first five books of the Bible. They're a collection of ancient stories, and stories are important. Telling stories in itself, quite apart from the content of the stories, is an act of hope making and meaning making. Simply gathering together and telling stories is an important act in itself, almost without it mattering what the story is. And communities tell stories about themselves as a way of creating and cementing identity. My favourite example from relatively modern history is of the way that we in England have tell stories about the Blitz. And we tell stories about Blitz spirits and so on. It's a very partial history. We don't tend to talk about looting and so on. But we tell stories about the Blitz and sort of say, whoa, look at us plucky Brits. We do this kind of community and identity meaning making through the stories that we tell about our past. That's what's going on in books like Deuteronomy. Someone once said, I love this quote, it's one of those things you can very easily find little memes of on the internet, very prettily designed, that fairy tales are more than true, not because they tell us that dragons exist, but because they tell us that dragons can be defeated. Now, I am not saying that the Old Testament is fairy tales. Don't get me wrong. But that is a really good way into understanding how these ancient stories can communicate with us now, because what they say about how to live in a desert nomadic culture was massively out of date, you know, even by the time that Jesus is around. People are not living out the rules of Deuteronomy in first century Judea. They're not practical. They're all about kind of, you know, where to put your boundary stone when you're camping. The festival rules don't apply back on your local streets. But what the stories tell us about, the way they give hope, the way they help us to make meaning, is really important. So the story that I've chosen to talk about today and for us to contemplate today is this story from Exodus chapter 5 of making bricks without straw. I'll read it now. So this is just after Moses has seen God in the burning bush, gone to Pharaoh and said, "Let my people go." That same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people, as well as their supervisors, "You shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But you shall require of them the same quantity of bricks as they have made previously. Do not diminish it, for they are lazy. That is why they cry, 'Let us go and offer sacrifice to our God.' Let heavier work be laid on them. Then they will labour at it and pay no attention to deceptive words." So the taskmasters and the supervisors of the people went out and said to the people, Thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go and get straw yourselves wherever you can find it, but your work will not be lessened in the least. So the people scattered throughout the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw. The taskmasters were urgent, saying, complete your work, the same daily assignment as when you were given straw. And the supervisors of the Israelites, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, why did you not finish the required quantity of bricks yesterday and today as you did before? Then the Israelite supervisors came to Pharaoh and cried, why do you treat your servants like this? No straw is given to your servants, yet they say to us, make bricks. Look how your servants are beaten. You are unjust to your own people. He said, you are lazy, lazy. That is why you say, let us go and sacrifice to the Lord. Go now and work, for no straw shall be given you, but you shall still deliver the same number of bricks. The Israelite supervisors saw that they were in trouble when they were told, you shall not lessen your daily number of bricks. As they left Pharaoh, they came upon Moses and Aaron, who were waiting to meet them. They said to them, the Lord look upon you and judge. You have brought us into bad odour with Pharaoh and his officials, and have put a sword in their hand to kill us. Then Moses turned to the Lord and said, O Lord, why have you mistreated this people? Why did you ever send me? Since I first came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has mistreated this people, and you have done nothing at all to deliver your people. Anyone who works probably knows the experience of being expected to be more and more productive all the time. I don't think many of us have ever tried making bricks with or without straw, but that experience of being expected to maintain productivity with fewer and fewer resources around, you know, oh, we're not going to replace Betty when she's left, that kind of thing, that is one that I imagine resonates with most of us. I want to start by putting this story into context, and I like to do that with almost like a series of brackets. I always find it quite helpful when you're looking at a Bible story, and perhaps particularly an Old Testament story like this. There's another blooming spider on here, but it's a smaller one. I can cope with that. to think of it as like a pebble dropped into a pool. So the particular story that we're looking at is the kind of centre that we happen to be choosing to focus on. You could drop a pebble anywhere into the pool, but this is where we've dropped this pebble. And then there's a series of ripples spreading out from it. Or you could think of it a bit like sort of looking at Google Maps and zooming out and out to try and get a wider and wider perspective of where that particular point of focus that you're looking at sits, and then zooming in again to look at the close detail. Or sometimes I find it helpful to look for the brackets around the story, the kind of open brackets. Quite often when you get a story, you can sort of see where it's starting. Go and look for the closed brackets somewhere else in the book, because it can really help to put the story into context, not just in a sense of, oh, this is what was going on for the people at the time, but in the sense of how this literary thing is being constructed and where it's going. So with this story, I think there's a really good example of that. So the first ring, the first brackets, the closest context is that this story sits, as I said, as the first result of Moses' miraculous encounter with God in the burning bush in Exodus 4. And Exodus is structured really with God appearing to Moses, a theophany, if you want the technical term, in that burning bush. And then the sort of culmination of that is that moment on the mountain of Sinai where the covenant is given. God commissions Moses to be the one who's going to lead his people from slavery in Egypt to freedom in the promised land, that massive metaphor that structures much of the Bible. And Moses, nervously but with courage, goes straight to Pharaoh to tell him to let the people go. Except he doesn't actually say, let my people go, just let us go, we're going to escape, we don't want to be slaves in Egypt anymore. He asks for permission for them to go off into the wilderness for a three-day worship festival. Pharaoh, perhaps unsurprisingly, says no. I don't know if anyone struggled to get time off for this. And my son couldn't get away from his bar job. And he's furious with them for asking. And this story is the story of his reprisals against the people. It's a collective punishment. That's the open bracket on My hands are going to go the wrong way for you. That's the open bracket on this side of the story. And then you've got the other side with the plagues. You know, there's 10 plagues, frogs and hail and the death of the firstborn at the very end, which finally and cumulatively convince Pharaoh to let the people go. If we then zoom out a bit further, how did the people of Israel get into this position in the first place? Why are they there? It's really relevant to understanding what's going on in this story. At the very beginning of chapter 1 of Exodus, you get a kind of reprise of the end of Genesis. So Genesis ends with all those stories of Joseph, you know, Joseph in the technicolor dream coat. Joseph goes out, he goes, he's really successful. Pharaoh has the dreams. Joseph does brilliant things, ends up getting put in charge, brings all his family there. At the beginning of the book of Exodus, we're told that Joseph's extended family who emigrated to Egypt were fruitful and multiplied. Again, similar to Exodus, to Ezekiel yesterday, that's language that very deliberately echoes Genesis. And that then subsequent generations of rulers became worried that they were going to be swamped by people of a different ethnicity who were fast outbreeding the indigenous people. Does that sound familiar? Suddenly, it doesn't sound quite so much like ancient history. It really is a story that has quite a lot of echoes and parallels with some of the rhetoric that we hear about immigration and some of the fears that are behind that. So, in chapter 1, verse 11, they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labour, and they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. They're making bricks because they're being used as forced labour to build the infrastructure that is going to enable the empire to even more efficiently oppress them. I think when I was a child and I read this, I kind of imagined them making bricks that were going to build the pyramids. Egypt seemed quite exotic, and I thought, oh, they're making bricks? Well, yeah, there's a dignity in craft labour, and they'll be making, maybe they're making houses. You know, bricks make houses, they make factories. Actually, when you look at the story in detail and go back to Exodus 1, they are making the infrastructure of their own oppression. And it's even more ironic than that if we zoom back into the end of Genesis. As I said, the reason they're in Egypt at all is because Joseph was so successful through his interpretation of dreams in helping the Egyptians survive that famine. If you don't get the references to this, then you can go and read the end of Genesis. It's a cracking yarn. Pharaoh has a dream of seven fat cows then being eaten up by seven skinny cows, and Joseph interprets this dream as meaning there are going to be 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of famine. This is good old Sunday school stuff. And so Pharaoh says, wow, brilliant, you're really intelligent, I'm going to put you in charge of making sure the people don't starve in the famine. Lovely story. However, what they don't tell us in Sunday school is how Joseph goes about doing that. He goes about building these great big barns, and he gathers things in, and then when the famine happens, he sells the grain to the people. And after the first few years, they've got no money left, and so they start having to sell themselves. And so the reason that Pharaoh is so pleased with Joseph is that by the end of the famine, all the Egyptian people, this isn't the Israelites, have sold themselves into slavery to the Pharaoh because of the way that Joseph had organized his economy. He's distorted the whole shape and fabric of society, and it ends, you know, and that's how people ended up paying taxes. So there's a real irony in the fact that now the people of God who are like, yay, we're the great heroes here, we're coming in as Joseph's wonderful family, have now been caught in the net that Joseph actually wove for the Egyptian people. And again, it seems to me that there is quite a lot here about, as we begin to come to terms with our history as being a slave-owning and an enslaving people, those of us who are British, who have that tradition and that history, as we come to terms with that and the uncomfortable nature of that, I think this story has quite a lot to say about how what seemed presumably like a really great economic decision a few centuries ago has ended up having such distorting effects on our society that we're now trying to work out how to put right. And then so we start off with them building supply cities for this whole, they're still being co-opted to build this infrastructure of oppression. And then one of the other things that I really like doing, little tip for those of you who are having to do Bible studies and preaching, is I love looking at the very beginning of a book and the very end of a book. Quite often, if you look at the very first chapter and the very last chapter, if you're trying to make sense of a story that doesn't make a lot of sense, it can really give a perspective on where's this whole story going, and therefore where is this episode fitting within it. We start Exodus with them building these supply cities, building the infrastructure of the empire that is oppressing them. We end with a cloud covering the tent. Exodus chapter 40, verses 34 to 38, very last words. A cloud is covering the tent of meeting, and they set out when the cloud moves up from it. The Nicholas King, incredible Ignatian scholar who translated the whole Bible himself, normally it's done by big committees, has translated these words as break up camp and move on, break up and move on. And it's this refrain, which a lot of our translations obscure because they use lots of different words for these two words. I can't pronounce Hebrew, but apparently it's Yisu and Masahem. And these mean pulling up, and very much in the context, pulling up tent pegs, breaking up camp and setting out. So it's often translated in our text just journeying. But that obscures the very specific and quite visceral and very, very specific camping reference here. This is about constantly pitching camp and then breaking camp, pitching camp and breaking camp. And there's this movement from building bricks to pitching and breaking camp and the work in that. If you're camping here, I know a lot of people are staying in hotels over in Kettering, but if you're camping here, you'll know that setting up camp takes quite a lot of time. And at the end, you can't just walk away. Greenbelters are famous for clearing up everything. You have to break camp and pack everything away and do all those backbreaking lugs of your trolley back up to the parking field. There's a lot of uprooting to do, pulling up the tent pegs, packing up, sorting out. And if you do it a lot, if you go camping all the time, or if you've got your greenbelt routine, you know what to do. And it happens a lot quicker. And we can imagine that the Israelites got really good at this and they had their routine. They knew that, you know, Joseph over there was going to go and get the water and, you know, Jeremy was going to be in charge of the tent setting up thing over here. They would have had their routine, but it's still a major operation. And it's natural that an essentially nomadic society would have had very specific words for breaking camp and pitching camp. But I think there's a real realism here about the need to break something up before you can move on. I think Exodus is a really fascinating book for us to reflect on because it's about the construction of identity through the construction and interpretation of retelling of a particular version of history. But it also explicitly rejects the old order of stability in favour of a moving, journeying existence, following a God whose presence is essentially ephemeral. And there's quite a lot later on about some of the tensions involved in doing that. So, brief context. Come back to the particular question of making bricks without straw. For a long time, I was really puzzled by this. I had kind of vague medieval sense of wattle and daub in my head, like bricks with bits of straw sticking out. And I was always rather confused because I thought, surely that would make the bricks weaker rather than stronger. Why would they be looking for straw to go in their bricks anyway? And then I saw a video on the internet, which I can't show here, but you can look it up. Of somebody in Egypt now making handmade bricks. It was a contemporary craftsman surrounded by thousands of bricks. They were very professional looking bricks and had the company name on them and everything, but they were making them by hand with a brick mold. So it was like a metal box that's brick shaped, had the company name stamped on the back in reverse. And what they were doing, it wasn't straw, like, you know, long bits of straw. It was chaff. It was the equivalent of when you're making pastry and you scatter the counter with flour and then roll the pastry out on the flour so it doesn't stick to your counter and to your cutter and to your pastry thing. So they were scattering, they're getting a lump of clay, scattering it on all surfaces with this chaff, this very, very finely chopped straw. I assume in this context it would have been primarily the chaff that gets whipped off of the threshing floor so that you get the grain. So this, like sawdust, effectively, you can imagine sawdust. They're scattering the clay with that so that it's like a bit of bread covered in flour. Then scattering the mould with that, shoving it into the mould, bash, 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 tap it out. And they were doing about maybe one of those a second. And you can imagine suddenly without the without the chaff, without the straw, it would be an absolute nightmare because it would be sticking to your hands. It would be sticking to the mould. You'd never get it out. You'd be trying to get bits off. Absolutely horrendous. You'd have to go and find the chaff. So that's what the straw is about. But of course, the point here isn't about the technicalities of brickmaking. This is not a brickmaking manual. The point is that their work has become exponentially harder without a key resource being provided, and they're expected to be just as productive. If you look at the text, if you happen to have it in front of you, you don't need to look at it, I'll tell you. One of the most prominent words, the word that's repeated most often, is the word lazy. Quite an unusual word in the Bible. It's not a word that comes up a lot in the Bible. Three times in verse 8 and then twice, Pharaoh says, "You are lazy, lazy," in verse 17. It seems to me there's a really strong link being made here, a kind of devil's advocate argument, you know, put it in the mouth of Pharaoh, between wanting to spend time in worship and laziness. That sense of, is it lazy to want a kind of work-life balance? Is it lazy to not want to be spending all your time being productive? They've asked for 3 days off to go off into the wilderness for a religious festival. That emphasis on laziness is one of those moments for me where time seems to collapse between this really quite alien culture thousands of years ago and our own very different contexts. Not a million miles away at all to the way our modern day culture finds it incredibly hard to value any activity that isn't obviously productive, that doesn't have a product at the end of it that you can count and say, well done, you've made as many of those as you did yesterday. You've got as many people coming to your church this week. Oh no. Have you increased the number of disciples in your church by 10% this year? If not, you're failing. It's the same thing. And it's fascinating, isn't it, to think, because it's very easy for us to think that kind of thinking is a product of our modern capitalist consumer society. And actually, yet here it is. It's something quite deep in human nature, I think, to equate spending time with worship with laziness. Very hard to resist, even in church life. And I wonder whether it's in church life or in your work life, feel like the Israelites, that you're being expected to achieve just as much as past generations did, but with fewer and fewer resources. I know friends working in the NHS and in schools and so on all have this same experience. There are less money, there's less money, there's less volunteers, there's less clergy. But we often internalise the demand to make just as many bricks as before, even though we've now got to go out and gather our own straw. Metaphorically, a lot of the things that simply used to be supplied by society for us in the kind of social contract aren't there anymore. And so I think in this really simple, dramatic image of making bricks without straw, Exodus can help us to articulate and help people to reflect on the unfairness of people being called lazy when their productivity doesn't match up to the demands of a greedy culture, which is demanding more and more for less and less. It's a really stark example of just how unfair that is, literally calling it out. It can help us affirm the dignity of those who aren't able to work or to work at full pace, whether that's the elderly, the ill, the disabled, children, carers, artists, dreamers, clergy. And it helps us, I think, it's quite specific that it is specifically the request to spend time in worship that's being called out as lazy here. They're not being called lazy because they weren't doing a good job making bricks. They were doing a perfectly good job making bricks. They're being called lazy because they've asked for some time off to go and worship a God that Pharaoh doesn't value. And I think we do quite often internalise in ourselves a sense that somehow giving time to prayer, giving time to worship is a bit self-indulgent. You know, maybe if you're in a habit of going to church on Sunday, you don't feel guilty about that. But, you know, going and doing something else is a bit like, I don't know if I can take the time away from the family. I don't know if I can take the time away from that. I've got to make sure I prepare for work properly the next day. We really internalise the sense that something like this is a bit of a self-indulgence. And this helps challenge that. But in a way, that's kind of quite an obvious, simplistic surface interpretation. I don't think that's wrong. The Bible has many, many layers of meaning in each story. as I say, it's very much part of this deep Israelite tradition of writing scripture and writing stories and storytelling, that a story is meant to be really chewed over. Wonderful image that was a real favourite of the medieval mystics, that talk about chewing a story over and really extracting all the juice from it, not just the initial flavour. I wonder if this story also challenges something much more deeply about how we build and maintain cultural capital and the infrastructure of our culture. I think much of our shared culture, and I'm talking here about kind of, you know, Western European culture in particular, and perhaps specifically within the English context, you know, the kind of, not the Church of England as it actually is, but the kind of the Church of England of the cultural imagination, the spinster cycling to evensong through the morning mists kind of thing. Something wrong with that quote, can't remember what it is. I think she was cycling to early communion, wasn't she, in the prayer, in the poem. I wonder if, as Christians, forgive me if you've come to a Bible study, so forgive me for misgendering you as Christians if that's not how you identify. But I wonder if we sometimes find ourselves, like the people of God in this story, as both historically privileged. They were there because they had this experience of being historically privileged. They were Joseph, who had been given the right hand of Pharaoh. They were his family. That's how they got there. They had this historic privilege. That's why they were there. And yet by this time, several centuries later, have been quite problematically co-opted by a society which is now using us for its own ends. I think our experience as the church is that we are being asked by wider society to make bricks without straw. The church, and as I say, I don't mean any particular denomination, I just mean that kind of general sense in the popular cultural imagination that the church is out there somewhere, is still expected to provide some of the basic building blocks of our society with fewer and fewer of the resources that we've been used to having. Practically, we're still expected, people still generally expect that there will be an open church when they walk down the streets, for the lonely or the distressed to walk into, and that when they do, as all the television shows show, there will be a vicar there who'll be rearranging the hymn books and will be conveniently available to be murdered or to give you a food parcel, whichever it is. But you know, actually, what murder mystery television shows show about churches is what people are expecting, that they are just there, they're open, the vicar lives in them, there's always someone there. We're expected to provide food and shelter for all those who need it. In England, something like a third of churches of all denominations are operating food banks now. The previous government came to rely on them as something like an emergency social service, and that's virtually impossible now to untangle. I was absolutely horrified when the church that I used to be vicar of hosts a food bank jointly with the two local cathedrals, and their annual report the year before the pandemic, they'd done the statistics and they found this random, dodgy, slightly falling down church in the middle of Liverpool had fed 1 in 11 of the UK's asylum seekers that year. You know, we think what we're doing is little and local, and actually it's absolutely necessary to be providing these building blocks. And yet, like all voluntary organisations, our donors and our volunteers are absolutely creaking at the seams and often themselves suffering as a result of the cost of living crisis. People expect there to be a vicar ready and able to answer the phone, to come to a bedside, to take a funeral. I was really struck. We kind of expected to have a Christmas and Easter service that fondly looks like the ones people vaguely remember from childhood, even though they don't want to go to it, but they get really angry if it's not on. Really struck by that in the pandemic, how angry some of the cultural commentators became, some of the journalists and columnists became at churches being closed at Christmas. I can understand anger from within the churches, but anger from cultured despisers of religion, to steal that phrase, who had no intention of going to church, but were kind of, you know, the good housekeeping vision of Christmas has this church service happening, and they were furious that it wasn't there anymore. And we expect this of ourselves as well, I think, as people who, however vaguely consider ourselves to be part of the church. So we're still being expected, not by any particular person individually, but by society, to be providing these bricks, to be the bricks of society, the basic building blocks of society. And yet, we are not being given straw. And I think there's an even more insidious and worrying way in which this is happening. From nationalism and the far right, we notice the way that that racist organisations and far-right organisations trade off the cultural capital of Christianity and expect it to continue to make bricks to build their empire. They are literally co-opting it, demanding more and more of that conceptual infrastructure. And then when we point out there's no straw, call us lazy. When we point out that that's not the kind of society we want to be building, that we would rather be off in a tent somewhere in a field, moving and journeying. People get really, really angry that we're not still committed to building those supply cities that they were relying on us for. But then, as I think through this, I think, but then if you go for a liberation theology reading of these passages, and Exodus, of course, is where liberation theology comes from. Liberation theology is Exodus theology. It's about being led from slavery, from all that enslaves us, to freedom in the promised land. It's a really powerful metaphor. But it always invites us to read the story from different perspectives. And it worries me slightly that we always tend to read the story of Exodus as if we're the ones being oppressed. And actually, are we the baddies? Mitchell and Webb reference for those of you who get it. I just wonder, should we always assume? I think we need to ask ourselves, and the answer might be no, we don't need to worry about that. But I think one of the things that liberation theology teaches us is when we're looking at a passage, we should always ask, where are we mentally locating ourselves in this story? And what happens if we do the uncomfortable thing of mentally locating ourselves with the baddie in the story? Or sometimes it's fascinating to do this with Jesus' parables. You know, so often there's a landowner or a lord, and we tend to assume that that's God. Actually, sometimes what happens if we assume that God is the vulnerable person in that story, and that maybe it's a story against landlords or lords? Just worth, you know, and it can be really uncomfortable because it goes against everything we've been trained to do. But it doesn't hurt to put ourselves into an uncomfortable position. May or may not be the right thing to do. May or may not mean that we might still decide that our original reading was correct, but it's worth asking the question. And so because we are beginning to wrestle very uncomfortably in our churches with the legacy of colonialism, I wonder how it looks if we allow ourselves as a thought experiment to read this story going, well, what if we're the Egyptians? Because it is a really deeply uncomfortable truth that I'm going to avoid saying our culture because that's really bad, but that white, my culture, white Western European intellectual middle-class culture has historically co-opted, enslaved Christianity to build its empire. I was a historian before I was ordained, and you know, that is the history of the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. If you haven't seen the After the Flood film, which really goes through how Christianity created racism, then I absolutely encourage you to do so. But, you know, what happened in the 16th century, when people first went to America, when white people, European people, first turned up in America, they did not distinguish by colour. It wasn't a thing. They distinguished, I mean, they were still horrible, but they distinguished by whether you were Christian or whether you were heathen. That was the distinction. That was the dualism, the binary. And initially, if you became a Christian, you were freed. You weren't a slave anymore. Well, that was not very economically helpful if you were trying to run a plantation. And so, if you haven't picked up the reason that the mission agencies are really, really struggling with this stuff is because what happened was the mission agencies, full of zeal, full of wanting to do the right thing, said, we want to go and convert all these people that you've got enslaved on your plantations. And the slave owners were going, absolutely not, because if you enslave, if you convert them, we're going to lose their labor. And so what happened was the mission agencies and theologians that were working with them, thinking they were doing the right thing, effectively created racism. And you can, I mean, one of my degree projects was on this. You can go back and you can read these sort of articles that people were writing where you can see them wrestling with and creating the concept of dark skin being a bad thing, and associating it with certain biblical stories and going and finding things and creating it and creating the concept that racism based on skin colour rather than on belief was what they were doing now. And there's about a 30-year period where it changed from being racism based on whether you were Christian or not to racism based on colour of skin. And that was created by Christians in order to be able to do evangelism. That's what we did. That's why, you know, if anyone is thinking, oh, it's woke nonsense, probably not a green belt, but a lot of people don't necessarily know that history. It's not just about wanting to, you know, be nice. It's about coming to terms with the fact that that is genuinely our fault. We created that. Our churches created that. So Christianity was put to work in the service of the empire. That's just perhaps the most egregious example. Sometimes deliberately, sometimes quite unconsciously. And it was used to help build the intellectual infrastructure that supported empire. So Exodus needs, I think, to deeply challenge us to confront our own corporate and national histories of acquisitiveness. You know, remember, this all started because Pharaoh was gathering everything together into barns, and Joseph was really great at helping him do that. He was really, really successful businessman. Of greed, of cruelty and oppression. But again, in a way, it's almost too easy, push it a step further, to think that's just on a historical level. You know, historically, people did that. I think whenever we read the Bible, and I think this is one of the things, again, that the Old Testament stories, I would really encourage you to read the Old Testament stories like this, and particularly the ones that really upset you. There's a really strong Ignatian principle that if you have an incredibly violent reaction to something, that's where you should spend time. So when I first started, you know, reading the Bible, there were points when I was a teenager, I wasn't a Christian, so don't come at me, but there were points when I was a teenager when I would read a story and I would throw the Bible across the room because I was so angry with it. And it's really easy to go, I'm not having nothing to do with that. I mean, the number of times people say to me, oh, I love Jesus, but I hate the horrible God of the Old Testament. You know, we just can't do that. We can't, you know, it's really intellectually incoherent. I think the point of those stories that make us angry is to invite us to draw ourselves further and further in and go, why is that making me so angry? Because I think often it's because the point of that story is it's evoked something of God's passion for justice in us. And we go, no, that is appalling. There is no way God or people should be able to behave like that. Well, then that story has really done its job for you, hasn't it? It's made the Bible isn't a kind of list of you've got to do all these things. It's a collection of stories that are trying to say, to provoke us, you know, in kind of modern artistic culture, it's a series of provocations. You could think of it like that. Think of it as a series of provocations, which are there to go, why has it upset me? Why has that made me feel like that? And as I say, if you ever read it and find yourself feeling a bit smug, you know, oh yeah, oh, they were terrible back in the old days, weren't they? Not like us. I would say that is also one of those strong emotions that we should really, really examine and go, ooh, What if I'm the other person in this story? Or which bit of me? Because I think very often when we're reading Bible stories, we think, gosh, I've gone on far too long, haven't I? My husband's at the back going, yeah, you should have held up a time saying stop. I've gone off my scripts. Yeah, I'll stop. No, I just want to say, back to the text. So where are we now as individuals? Or perhaps as the contemporary church, because this isn't primarily meant to be read on an individual level, but a corporate level. Where are we guilty of demanding of others that they make bricks without straw? Where are we doing that to other people now? Where are we guilty of exploiting people to build the infrastructure of our own empires? I think that's the question it asks us. And lastly, I just want to leave you with, notice at the very end, the result of this experience on the people is that they turn on Moses and Aaron and accuse them of being the ones who made their situation worse. And I think it's a really stark warning that when people start saying, actually, this isn't good enough, this, things should be different, it's really uncomfortable at first. And it often does make our situation worse before it makes it better. And it's so tempting to lash out on the people who are doing that rather than, you know, being patient and accepting that things are going to get worse potentially if we're trying to make really, really significant change. So I'm going to leave. We've still got 15 minutes, so I'll stop going off my rant. This is why I write it down, to keep myself to time, and then I start ignoring my script and it's not good. We're going to have a quick go. We're going to do this really quickly. So I'm going to ask you to get your piece of plain paper. If you haven't got a piece of plain paper, there are some spare ones here. So stick a hand up and someone will come and give you one. I've got a sample, because when I tried this in church, everyone wrote on the wrong bits of the side of the paper. So I'm going to do a big demonstration. We're going to attempt to write kind of psalms. Have any of you ever played the game Consequences? Okay, we're going to do Psalm Consequences. And we're going to do a bit of collaborative thing. So you need to write these things down really quickly without thinking. You need to just do a quick fire round. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give a first word, a subject for your sentence and a first word. And you're going to start writing that first word. I haven't printed them because I want you to actually write it, because once you've started with your hand moving, it's easier to carry on. And just finish the sentence, finish a line. So your first sentence is going to begin, I feel. So you're going to write at the top of the page, you're going to write, I feel, and you're going to finish that sentence. Okay, this is where it all went wrong in my church when I did a little sample prep version. We ended up with people writing on the back. So then, I feel, finish the sentence. Then you're going to fold it over. You're going to fold it over quite small so that there is still space afterwards. Okay, and then you are going to write the next bit on the front of the paper where you have folded it over. So you're covering the words you've just written, covering over the words you have written, and the bottom of that line is the top of where you are now going to write underneath, okay? You are not going to turn it round and write on the back. You are not going to write on the flap. Okay. Second line, so you now give this to someone else. Doesn't matter which way you go, just make sure you've not got the same bit of paper. Okay. Just pass it to the person next to you next time. We haven't got time for this. Now you're going to address God. You can say, oh God, or if you'd prefer to use a different name or title for God, then you can use something else. But oh God, or whatever word equivalent, you, and then finish that sentence. So what do you want to say to God? So you're going to write just underneath that flap, oh God, you, dot, dot, dot. And then again, you're going to fold it over. So the folded bit at the top is going to get thicker because you're going to fold it at the same point. So it should be the same size. Fold it over again on the front like that. So you've now got three folds, three layers of paper at the top. And pass it on to the person next to you. Okay, now the next one. When you read the Psalms of Lament quite often have very specific, they get quite specific. So they say things like, when I lie down on my bed, I weep. Or when I think about X, you know, I feel a particularly strong emotion. So I want you to think about a time when you're feeling particularly affected by the pain of the world, or when you're feeling particularly hopeless. What is it? So it could be when I watch the news, when I'm on my bed, when I can't sleep, whatever. When, and I want you to start this, when, and then... When I, and then finish that sentence. Okay, and now I want you to think about resources that you have for making hope. So I was moving a bit away from the Exodus thing. So it might be a particular Bible story. It might be something in your life. It might be something in the world that gives you some hope. And I want you to start this sentence, I think about... Okay, and as you're finishing that off, the next one is going to be the same as that, because Psalms very often have pairs. So you're going to fold it over and pass it on, and then keep thinking, because you're going to start your next one, I think about, and write something else. You've got to think hard. Two things that bring you some sort of hope. Again, it could be something from the Bible, it could be something from the world. I'm going to try and keep people together, so I'm just going to wait till people aren't moving around quite so much. Okay. So your last one, just in this moment, How are you feeling? What do you want to say to God now? So I want you to start this one now. So this one is it could be how you're feeling now or what you want to say to God now or what you're thinking now. So I want the first word to be now. Okay, now, we haven't got a huge amount of time. So what I want you to do, the one you've got now is this group's gift to you. So this is yours to take away. This is like your psalm. I want you to just get into twos or threes and read them to each other. And then maybe if like just a few people, a handful of people who think they've got one that works particularly well would like to stick their hand up and we'll come around with a roving mic. But just for the next couple of minutes, just share them in a small group. Read them all out in the two or three people who are around you. Okay, we have to clear this venue in just the 3 or 4 minutes because the next event needs to set up. So we've just probably got time for two or three people to read them out. So we're going to come round with the roving mic. If you've got, where have we got one that wants to?
I feel angry about the oppression of Gaza and the West Bank. Oh God, you could take away all this discomfort in the world. When I am anxious, I seek your face. I think about your providence. I think about the brilliant, loving people I know. Now there is hope to hold on to.
Wow.
I feel we need to be kinder. Oh God, you put the weight of the world on my back. When I hear of the atrocities on civilians in Gaza, I weep. I think about how you walked in this world and remember your example. And I think about the challenge to be a channel of your peace, love, and transforming power. Now I commit myself again to travel with hope.
I feel content. Oh God, your will must be done. When I look at Gaza, I weep. I think about my grandchildren. I think about the gifts you have given us. Now I am surprised by your joy.
Okay. One over here, I think.
Okay. I feel angry at the abuse of power. Oh God, you must be weeping at how we do not care for others. When I see the news, I want to switch off because it is unbearable even to watch. I think about hope as an active muscular process which needs practice. I think about your faithfulness. Now I ask you, God, to give me inspiration and strength to make a difference for others for you.
Can I be here?
Fantastic. Have we got one more?
I feel oppressed by the growth of anti-refugee strikes today. O creation, you hold us all in dignity. When I look at the people on the streets begging, I think about our friends, their friends, our work colleagues. I think about refugees and asylum seekers. Now I am humbled and wind my neck in.
You're all fabulous. You wrote those.
Well, thank you ever so much, Miranda. That was amazing. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.